of in generating our motivation today, let's recall that we have this opportunity due to causes that we created ourselves in the past, and also due to the kindness of others who have provided the circumstances that we have now, so that we have the opportunity to come. And also through our present way of thinking, that we have the motivation, the intention to learn the Dharma. So a lot of different things had to come together for this opportunity to happen. It's not some predestined thing that exists from its own side that we can take for granted, but something that's dependent on a constellation of causes and conditions. And so therefore to really take advantage of it while we can. And since many of the conditions that we rely on to have this opportunity to hear the Dharma came due to the efforts of other beings, then let's really include all of them in our motivation and take up the responsibility to benefit them through our practice, specifically by generating all the realizations of the path, no matter how long it takes, so that we can repay their kindness by also helping them along the path. Let's have that be our intention. This morning I looked out my window and there was a big car that drove up and went back to the barn, and I'm going, what's that? Who's that? So I went out to check, and it was Sean, who made a special trip up here simply to pick up our garbage and our recycling and take them to the dump. And he drove all the way from Spokane up here, you know, together with Scissor and John's help, loaded all that stuff into the back of this big vehicle, and then went and delivered it at the dump in the recycling station. And that's the whole reason why he drove that whole long way to come up here. And it really made me stop and think, you know, here he is doing, really going out of his way, really out of his way, to do something that would help us so that we can do our meditation sessions without having to, you know, take the garbage to the dump in the recycling station ourselves. And he did this, I mean, just completely out of the kindness of his heart. But it made me really stop, and I felt like, wow, I have some responsibility. If somebody's really going out of his way to do something like that, and this whole retreat, we have many people going out of their way to do small things for us that become big things for them because we're out in the middle of nowhere and it's hard for them to get here. And they do this with such happiness and such a feeling of generosity that I have a responsibility to really use my time on the cushion and off the cushion, in a responsible way. and not just let my self-centered mind run the show. Yeah? Because if they're sacrificing like that, it's with because they have some kind of faith in what we're doing and some confidence that our having the undisturbed retreat time will benefit us and benefit others. And so in the middle of that, if I just take time out to feel sorry for myself or to complain or to be disgruntled because, you know, somebody's walking and their footsteps are too loud and I don't like it, or I'm disgruntled because the way they washed the dish wasn't clean enough for my standards, or, you know, any of the numerous things that our picky self-centered mind gets wigged out about, that if I just let that happen and go along with it and let that kind of thought stay in my mind, then I'm really betraying the trust that those people have. I'm not doing my side, yeah, to really honor and respect what they're doing. Yeah. And so, you know, to really think about this and, you know, think about the number of people who are helping us that we don't see every day, that we don't think about. You know, somebody writes our checks for us, somebody balances the books for us. You know, somebody does the grocery shopping. I mean, people do so many things for us. And so we, you know, when our self-centered mind comes up, you know, we have to do something with it. We can't just let it stay there. Yeah. So, yeah. So we have some responsibility in here. Don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Yeah? If I just kind of stay here and don't even think about all the people who are doing the things so that I have this opportunity, you know, and instead, because it's retreat time and all I have to do is think about myself, so all I do is think about myself. Oh, I have this problem, I have that problem, I can't concentrate, my mind's such a mess, my little toe is throbbing, I can't stand it. You know? And every day, just, you know, this kind of stuff, then, you know, then I'm not doing my part of the deal. Hmm? Yeah?
I just wanted to mention that I didn't do anything with the garbage. I didn't even know about it. You said that I helped.
Yeah, weren't you out there helping to load it?
No, I didn't even know anyone was there.
Oh, okay, then it was just Cesar.
It was all Cesar.
Thank you, Cesar. I thought both of you were there. So, yeah, but really to think about this and where we let our mind go. Because it's very natural that self-centeredness will arise in our mind, and attachment and anger and laziness and procrastination, all these things will arise in our mind. That's not the thing. But it's letting them stay there. It's believing in them when they arise and not seeing that they're defilements. Yeah. So the complaining mind comes up. I don't like this. I need that. And instead of saying, oh, that's the mind of attachment. That's the mind of dissatisfaction. That's the mind of anger. We say, oh, but I really do need that. It's really important. I have to have this. And I'm so miserable now because I don't have it. You know, it's letting that mind stay there and believing it. That's, you know, where we're not keeping our part of the deal. The fact that it arises, you know, we're ordinary human beings. That's going to happen. Okay. But it's not recognizing it as a defilement and then just going along with it. Or what's equally not doing our part is we recognize it as a defilement and then we spend all of our time criticizing ourselves. I'm so bad. Look at this. I can't concentrate. My mind's a mess. I can't do this. I can't do that. Everything's wrong. I'm not keeping my part of the deal. This whole thing is hopeless. My mind is a mess. This whole thing. Ah! That is equally as self-centered. Equally. Yeah. So letting those thoughts of self-deprecation come in your mind and following them, that's just as self-centered as the other extreme of not even recognizing them as, you know, non-virtuous and just going along and with all of our self-indulgent thoughts. Yeah. So, think about it. Okay. So I wanted to, the verse that we, that we covered last week, yeah? So I just wanted to, because there were a lot of details in that, is to review it. Okay, so just the four lines. First, prevent the demeritorious. Next, prevent, in parenthesis, ideas of a coarse self. Later, prevent views of all kind. Whoever knows of this is wise. So this is outlining the path for us. First, prevent the demeritorious means first to stop creating non-virtue. In other words, the kind of non-virtue that will ripen in our having a rebirth in the lower realms. Okay, demeritorious karma. And then next, the second steps, when you have that good ethical conduct and you can, you know, kind of get your act together somewhat. Second step is next prevent, the verse says next prevent the self, but it means ideas of a coarse self. And so under coarse self, we have a permanent, partless, independent self, like that's a soul or an Atman. And we also have a self-sufficient, substantially existent self that's like a self that is the controller and manager of the aggregates. Okay? So we want to meditate to subdue the grasping at both of those kinds of selves. Yeah? The first one, the permanent, partless, independent self, the mind that adheres to that is an acquired affliction that we learn from incorrect philosophy. The self-sufficient, substantially existent self has both an acquired dimension and an innate dimension. The innate, you know, one came from previous lives. The acquired one is when we build a philosophy around it and validate it through that philosophy and believe that. Okay, then the third line, later prevent views of all kinds, that's advancing us from not just negating or disproving a permanent, partless, independent self or a self-sufficient, substantially existent self, but also a self that exists inherently by its own nature, under its own power, from its own side. Okay? And so for that, for the third line, you know, later prevent views of all kinds, for that, then we have to have the view of the Prasangika Madhyamakas. Yeah, the lower Buddhist schools, you know, will negate the one expressed in the second line. Yeah, the coarse views of self, but they won't, they can't refute the inherently existent one. So that's what we're being told to do on the third line. And then whoever knows of this is wise. So, meaning this is the path to get ourselves out of cyclic existence by doing these three steps. Okay? And they build upon each other. Yeah? Because it's going to be much easier to live an ethical life than it is to negate a coarse view of self. And it's much easier to negate a coarse view of self than to recognize and refute the subtle self. Okay? And let go of the view of the subtle self. Okay? Now, in terms of this, yeah, when you are refuting the self, yeah, either a self-sufficient, substantially existent one, or an inherently existent one, the steps are the same in refuting it. The difference is the object of negation. Okay? So sometimes we hear about the four-point analysis. So first, to identify the object of negation. Second, to establish the pervasion that if the self existed, and then whatever it is that you're checking about, then it would have to be either one with the aggregates or different from the aggregates. Okay, and then the third point is checking if it's one, the fourth point is checking if it's different. Yeah. So the difference is in these things is in what your object of negation is. If you're negating a self-sufficient, substantially existent self, or if you're negating an inherently existent self. And so that's why that first step of identifying the object of negation is so important. Yeah. The method of negating it is basically the same. Yeah. And so, last week I talked about these different views of the self from the Kulla-Radala Sutra. Yeah. And how those are actually all acquired views. They're not innate views of the self. But the point is that if the self existed as a self-sufficient, substantial entity, it would have to exist in one of those ways. Or if it existed inherently, it would have to exist in one of those ways. Okay? And so therefore, when Nagarjuna set up his refutation, yeah, he did it in reference to those different views. Okay, so when Nagarjuna's refutation, the first two points, you have the first four points of the four-point analysis. They're exactly what I said. But then there's some more, there's three more that help us analyze the relationship between the self and the aggregates in even a more subtle way. Okay, and they correspond with some of the other acquired wrong views that were mentioned in the sutra. Okay, so Nagarjuna is saying that things don't exist that way. Okay, so Nagarjuna's fivefold analysis, yeah, don't get that. Don't think, oh, well, he only added one point to the fourfold analysis. No, the first two points are the same. Yeah, identifying the objects of negation, and then the pervasion that if the self existed, that, you know, as that, it would have to be either one or different. Okay, those are the same. Then, for the 5 points that Nagarjuna uses to refute it, so here, let's say we're negating the inherently existent self, okay? Then you would say, if the self existed inherently, then it would have to be either inherently one or inherently different, you know, in relationship to the aggregates. So then you start examining, you know, is the self inherently one and the same as the aggregates? Yeah. If the self and the aggregates were exactly the same, then even having the word self would be totally redundant because the self and the aggregates do exactly the same thing. So that's not true. Okay. The second of his 5 points is they're not inherently different. If the self and the aggregates were inherently different, then something could happen to the aggregates without it happening to the self. Or the aggregates can be one place and the self could be somewhere else. They would have no relationship, you know. And there would be no way for, I mean, there's a lot of things, I'm not going into detail in this refutation right now. Okay, then the third one is the self doesn't inherently depend on or exist inside the aggregates. So sometimes you have the thing, you get the, you know, you have to say, well, you know, they're the aggregates and the self depends on the aggregates. You know, it has some relationship of it inherently depends on the aggregates, or it inherently exists inside the aggregates. Yeah. And so, you know, if the self existed inherently, you know, then can you find it in that way? I mean, if the self existed inherently, it might be able to exist in that way. But does it? When you examine, you know, does the self inherently depend on the aggregates? No. Does it exist inside the aggregates, kind of like a lion in the forest? No. Yeah. Although sometimes we have that feeling, don't we?
Sure do.
You know? Yeah, there's that little homunculus inside of us somewhere. But if you really analyze, you know, if there were a self that you could find under ultimate analysis, then you should be able to find it there. Okay. So, yeah. So that one actually is seeing, you know, if the help of the self inherently depends on or exists inside the aggregates, that one's actually another way of analyzing, are they different? Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's just a different way to look at it. Okay? And the fourth of Nagarjuna's points, the aggregates do not inherently depend on the self or dwell within the self. So sometimes we, you know, if the self inherently existed, then could it be that there's the self and then the aggregates depend? The self is the solid thing and the aggregates depend on it. Or the self is the container and the aggregates are what fill it up, you know. And sometimes we get that idea. It's kind of like there's this idea of a self, like it's spread out all and it covers all the aggregates. But then you have to ask yourself, does the self exist in that way? Yeah? Is the self like, you know, kind of snow on top of the forest? Or is it like sauce on the spaghetti? Or is it like the bowl with fruit in it? Yeah, well, no, you know, when you start doing that. When you start asking. And that, again, is an analysis. It boils down to, are the self and the aggregates different? Then the fifth one is that the self doesn't inherently possess the aggregates. Okay. Now, there's two ways that something can possess something else. One is like a person possessing their ear. And the other way is like a person possessing a piece of furniture. Okay? A person possessing their ear, it boils down to, are the self and the aggregates the same thing? And or does the self possess the aggregates like a person possesses a piece of furniture? That boils down to, are the self and the aggregates completely different? Like the person and the furniture are completely different. Whereas the person and their ear aren't totally different, are they? Yeah, there's a relationship between them. Okay, so that fifth one has aspects of one and also has aspects of different. Then Chandrakirti has a 7-point analysis and he added 2 more. Okay, so one is, you know, is the self, can, if you're trying to look for this self, is it the shape of the aggregates, specifically the body? Yeah. Because sometimes we look and we see like the outside of somebody's body and their shape. Oh, there's so-and-so. Yeah. But are you the shape of your body? Yeah. If you were the shape of your body, then where's your mind? Then your mind doesn't have anything to do with it, does it? Yeah, the mind's totally left out. So, no, I'm not the shape of my body. And then the tricky one, that the seventh point that Chandrakirti put in was, is the I the collection of the aggregates? Because before, when we're analyzing, is the I one with the aggregates, we go through each aggregate individually, and, you know, we can't say I'm my, you know, the self is the body, or the self is the feelings, or whatever it is, because that just leaves out too many things. But we're very tempted to go, oh, but the self is the collection of the aggregates. Yeah, that's what I am. I'm the collection of the aggregates. Okay. But then, and it's very tempting to go with that one, isn't it? It's like, yeah, of course I'm not one aggregate. Yeah, and I'm not different from the aggregates. But I'm the collection. You put all the aggregates together, and then there's me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right? But the thing is that the collection, a collection, is actually just a group of many parts. So if you're going to say that you're the collection, since the collection is dependent upon the individual aggregates, you're actually back looking at, am I this aggregate or that aggregate or the other one? Because a collection is something that is obviously imputed, that obviously doesn't have its own nature, that is just a group of parts. Okay. So again, it's like, I'm the collection. Well, no, because that throws me right back into, am I each, you know, if the self were inherently existent, I would still have to find something. That was it. Because I can't find a thing that's the collection. Yeah? When I say, oh, I'm the collection of the aggregates, what are you going to point to as a collection? Show me a collection. Yeah? A collection? Remember collections? They're one of those abstract phenomena that... yeah? That our mind invented. Okay.
I think, Venerable, this one can be quite dicey because you can think about the collection and it almost sounds like, if you're not paying much attention, that it's very much the same as, oh yeah, the self is dependent on its parts. I mean, imputed independence on its parts, right? You can. There's a way your mind can solidify even that idea.
Right.
As this.
Yeah. Well, but then again, the thing is, if the self, which is the designated object, were the collection of the parts, which is the basis of designation, mm-hmm. then the designated object and the basis of designation become exactly one and the same.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a problem if they're one and the same. Because we always talk about, you know, that... The object is designated in dependence on the basis of designation. If they're one and the same, then it can't be designated because it is it. If the object is the basis of designation, then there's no designation process.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they're completely the same. Yeah. Hmm? It's like the first one, yeah. Yeah. And so that's the thing with one of the proofs of, you know, when you're investigating, is the I, you know, one and the same with the aggregate, is that if it were, if they were, the I were the same as the aggregates, identical to the aggregates, then the, what they say, the agent and the object, there would be no difference. Everything would get missed up, you know, confused. Because we talk about the self taking the aggregates, but if the self is the aggregates, then we can't say that the self takes the aggregates and abandons the aggregates or anything. And we couldn't say the self is labeled independence on the aggregates. Or we couldn't even say the self depends on the aggregates, because for things to depend on each other, they have to be different, but not inherently different. Yeah. So this is the thing, the self and the aggregates, okay, they're one nature in the sense that the self depends on the aggregates. Yeah. And the self can't exist aside from the aggregates. So this, the self is one nature with the aggregates, but it is not one with the aggregates. Okay. The self is different from the aggregates because you identify the self and the aggregates differently, but the self and the aggregates are not different natures. Okay, so this is something to really sit and think about and go around. Okay, the self is one nature with the aggregates, but it's not one or identical with the aggregates. The self and the aggregates are different things. You identify them differently. But they're not different natures because the self depends on the aggregates. Yeah?
So that's true with any designated object in
its space. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because if you look at the cup, okay, the cup is designated on the clay and the enamel and the shape and, you know, all these different things. But it's not the same as them. But it depends on them. So the cup and the materials that the cup are made out of have a dependent relationship. Yeah. They share the nature, a nature, but they're not exactly the same. So they're different. The cup and the clay and the enamel are different, but they're not totally different natures, because the cup is dependent on the clay and the enamel to exist. Okay? Yeah. So it happens with everything. Yeah.
In my memory, I think also the one nature means that they're both empty of any inherent existence from their own side. Isn't there something about nominally distinct, that things are of one nature and nominally distinct?
Oh, okay. That okay. Yeah, when you talk about things being of one nature but nominally distinct. Yeah, you could say the self and the aggregates are one nature but nominally distinct. But that phrase usually comes up when we're talking about the two truths.
Okay, that's right.
Yeah, an object and its emptiness mm-hmm. are the same nature, in that one cannot exist separate from the other, but they're nominally distinct. They are not the same thing.
Okay, that's right.
Yeah.
But one nature here means they depend on each other and they always exist together?
Yeah.
Those are the two
parts of one nature. Yeah, one, yeah. Yeah, they depend on each other and they exist at the same time. There's two ways that things can have a relationship. You know, generally, at least when you're first introduced to the topic of relationship, one is a cause and effect relationship, and one is a relationship of having one nature. Okay? Cause and effect don't exist at the same time. They can't exist at the same time. But things that are one nature necessarily exist at the same time.
Can I ask a question about these being acquired?
Uh-huh.
I can't say that that doesn't feel right, but I was thinking about that kind of this week. It's like, well, it sure doesn't feel like they're all acquired. Some of it feels quite innate. And
yeah.
So how come they got that label? And,
yeah.
And then if they're acquired, what is innate?
Yes. Yes. I know that question because I had that feeling too. It was like just permanent, partless, and dependent me. That feels quite innate. You know, there's a real me in there that's permanent, that's unitary, that's independent of causes and conditions. But then I realize actually what they're talking about there, mm-hmm. when they're talking about that, they're really talking about the idea of a soul or an Atman. Mm-hmm. And a soul is an idea that people created.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's intellectually manufactured. Yeah, we think, oh, there's a person, they have a soul. The soul, you know, doesn't depend on causes and conditions. It's permanent. It doesn't depend on the aggregates. It's just one soul, one unitary thing. And then you realize, oh, yeah, I was taught that, wasn't I?
Yeah.
And so actually, sometimes the acquired things are still very deep inside of us. Yeah. I mean, even a lot of our identities, like, you know, what's an identity that you hold on to strongly?
What's female.
What? Okay. I'm a woman, okay? Yeah, so that's an identity that you hold on to very strongly. But were you born with that mind that said, I'm a woman? Well, do you think little baby girls know that they're different than little baby boys? Do you think little kids think about that?
It starts pretty little.
But it's taught.
But is it taught?
But it's taught, isn't it?
Great repetition.
Yeah.
Huge repetition.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you're a girl, therefore, da 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 da. You're a boy, therefore, da da da.
Well, right from the color of your little baby blankie.
Yeah, right. Your baby blankie, and you know, and the balloon that they hang outside of the house when they take you home.
Before you're born.
Yeah, yeah. Now they know before you're born. It used to be a surprise. Yeah, but now even before you're born, they know. And so, yeah, a lot of that identity is, but it's all taught. But this goes to show how deep a lot of the things that are acquired are. Even though they're acquired, they're really in there, and we cling to them fervently. And it's because we have the innate self-grasping that we cling to these acquired identities so strongly. If we didn't have the innate self-grasping, people could still teach us all of this, but we wouldn't identify so strongly with it. Yeah. Very often, if you belong to a group that is an oppressed group, that identity becomes very strong for you, whether it's, you know, on the basis of race or social class or ethnicity or religion or gender, or sexual orientation, or, you know, hobbies, or nationalities, or, you know, economic class. Any of these things can become like a huge identity. Yeah, that's acquired, but that you will live and die for. Yeah? People live and die for their identities. You are mistreating my group. Therefore, I have the, you know, right to bomb you or do this or do that. Yeah, because this is my group, this is me. But it's all an identity that's simply been learned in this life. But because we have the innate self-grasping, we hold on to that. Yeah.
In 1990, I had an experience. There was a CD going around, How to Attract Your Soulmate.
How to Attract a Soulmate.
Yes.
Ah.
And there were exercises to do. And when you were in contact with that soulmate, you had a click in your heart.
Yeah.
And I got the experience.
Oh, yeah.
Got the physical click in my heart and everything.
Yeah.
It was a mess, that relationship.
But you see, this is because. Okay, so she said.
That's what I, like what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's so strong that you create
so
your mind physically.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. This is actually very. This I gotta repeat for the people that she's saying that in the 1990s there was a CD about how to attract a soulmate, and there were all these exercises that you did to attract your soulmate, and when you got it, you felt a click in your heart. Yeah. And so she did the exercises, and she felt the click in her heart physically, and the relationship was a mess. But it's an example of how much, just through the power of being taught something, we believe it, and even you got a physical sensation out of it that was totally made up. I mean, that you had simply because of your mind.
And I was amazed. Wow.
Yeah. It worked. I felt the click in my heart. It was just the wrong click.
And they didn't explain that. Poor.
Yeah.
That was a fine print.
You're right.
Some clicks are mushrooms.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, don't trust your clicks. Yeah. But I was just thinking today, you know, because we got this new little kind of tablet computer thing, and it has all these, trying to get this thing to shut up was quite an endeavor. There was this narrator who's talking, do you want to do this, do you want to do that? Every time you press a key, it beeped, it clicked, it, you know? It was like the noisiest thing. And I realized, you know, why do they have this? I mean, the narrator for somebody, let's say, who's blind is very helpful, okay? But aside from that, you know, why all these things? It feeds the sense of I. Look, I am so important that when I press this, a sound comes. Not only a letter comes on the computer because I'm typing, but I can make this thing make a sound. And I can make this thing talk to me in English. And I can. Look what I can do. I mean, it just reinforces the sense of I all over the place.
Sounds exactly like a toy my 3-year-old nephew got while I was visiting your family at Christmas.
Yeah!
There's the button. Oh, it does. Oink, oink. There's the button. It goes, ah!
It is just like the toy your nephew got. Yeah.
It never stops. It never ends.
No.
It oh, never goodness. Ends.
Yeah. Yeah, look what I can do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It gives you a false sense of control and power.
Yeah.
Yeah. All these devices now come with personal assistants, and I've heard people talk to them like, Siri, call home.
Oh, yeah, your personal Siri, yeah, she has a name.
Yeah.
Siri, you messed up. No, I didn't. Have compassion on me. Yeah. Yeah. But the point here is the power of even the acquired afflictions. You know? Similarly, like with anger, we have innate anger. But we also learn who to hate, don't we? And we learn who to get angry at. Yeah, we learned that from our parents. Same thing. We have innate, desire and attachment and craving, but where it lands, you know, what we happen to be attached to, we learn that. Yeah. We learn it in our families, we learn it in our school. So you're attached to your looks, or you're attached to your comfort, or you're attached to your reputation, or you're attached to, you know, whatever it is, the score on your tests. Yeah, so we learn different things to be attached to. And then those things just get magnified in importance in our life. Okay, so that was last week's verse. Let's go on to this week's verse. So, this week's verse, verse 191, is another one of these famous ones. Remember I was telling you that there's these famous verses? So the last one we did, 190, was famous, and this one, 191, is also very, very famous. It's quoted quite a bit. Okay, so it's about the indistinguishability in entity with respect to the final mode of existence of things. What that means is that everything is empty of inherent existence. There's no, you can't, from the point of view of experience, you cannot distinguish between the emptiness of one object and the emptiness of another one. Okay, so Joe Blow says, by what path is liberation attained? Good question, Joe. The answer is, compared to some of his usual questions, the answer is by understanding that all phenomena are empty of inherent existence. And so though Joe says, well, since sentient beings are limitless, so are their realities, so is their emptiness, and you can't attain liberation unless you see all these different emptinesses, so, you know, and unless you've abandoned every single defilement, yeah, so how am I ever going to get to be liberated? And the answer is, no problem, no fault, Joe. So Aryadeva says, whoever sees one thing is said to see all. That which is the emptiness of one is the emptiness of all. Okay, so you have to understand what this means. Otherwise, whoever sees one thing is said to see all. It's like, you know, well, I looked at the package of tissues and I know the universe. No, it's not that, okay? So what it means is when you see one, the emptiness of inherent existence of one phenomena, then you've seen the reality, the ultimate nature of all phenomena, because they're all empty of inherent existence. So the King of the Concentration Sutra says, through one all are known, and through one all are seen. So that's having the same meaning as this quote. So for example, if you drink one drop of salt water, or one drop of ocean water, you know what all the other drops in the ocean are going to taste like, because they're all going to be salty. Yeah. So the emptiness of true existence is the ultimate mode of existence of all phenomena. It doesn't appear differently in different ways, like the emptiness of the tissues, the emptiness of me, the emptiness of the camera. All these emptinesses do not appear differently to the mind that is cognizing them. Okay, like when you look at colors appear differently to the mind cognizing them. Red looks like red and blue looks like blue. Okay, but when you're cognizing emptiness, yeah, either by inference or by direct perception, yeah, the emptiness you're cognizing appears the same, you know, whether it's the emptiness of this object or the emptiness of that object. Okay? So you can distinguish nominally that the emptiness of Joe is different than the emptiness of Susan. Okay, nominally they're distinct. But if you realize, you know, by inference, the emptiness of Joe, if you just switch your mind to Susan, immediately you're going to know the emptiness of Susan. Even though your awareness of emptiness was conceptual, it's due to an inference, a valid cognizer, that's an inference. When it's conceptual, when it's by inference, like you might be meditating and you get the inference, you first meditate on the absence of inherent existence of yourself, okay? So you get an inference that, oh yeah, you know, I am empty because I'm a dependent arising, and you get that inference, or I'm empty because I don't arise from self, other, both, or causelessly, whatever the reasoning is, or I'm empty because I'm not one with the aggregates or different from the aggregates, you know. So you get that inference, okay? Then, you know, you don't have to. Then if you want to know the emptiness of another object, start all over and do the whole, you know, negation and the reasoning all over again from the top to realize the emptiness of this, and then you have to do it again to realize the emptiness of that. I mean, then you'd never, you know, get there. But all you do, because emptiness, the emptiness of all these different things is it doesn't appear differently to the mind cognizing it, is you shift your mind, you know, from yourself to, you know, the parakeet, and then you realize, oh, the parakeet is empty of inherent existence. Yeah. And then you switch that to one of your favorite identities, you know, and oh, that's also empty of inherent existence. So it goes very quickly like that with inference. In terms of direct cognizers, when you directly see the emptiness of one phenomena, you simultaneously have seen the emptiness of all phenomena. Okay, so there's a difference here. With inference, you don't see the emptiness of all the different phenomena simultaneously, but with a direct perceiver, you do.
From the first time.
Yeah, from the first time, the first moment of a direct perceiver of emptiness. Okay. The emptiness of two different objects doesn't appear differently, like red and blue do. Okay. However, it's not that the inference cognizing the pot's emptiness cognizes the parakeet's emptiness. Okay, when we're talking about inference, yeah, the mind that's been meditating on the emptiness of the pot and that cognizes the pot's emptiness, at that same moment does not cognize the parakeet's emptiness. Okay, you have to, okay, it's like space in different receptacles, yeah, the space in here and the space in here are different spaces. Yeah, even though they appear, they're both the lack of obstructability. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the lack of true existence of another thing, you're meditating on the emptiness of the eye, the lack of true existence of another thing can be cognized merely by, we're talking here in terms of inference, merely by directing the mind to it and examining if it's truly existent or not. So the whole process of reasoning that induce the initial cognition doesn't need to be repeated. Okay, that's for inference, okay, which is conceptual. For a direct perceiver, if you directly perceive the emptiness of one thing, that is directly perceiving the emptiness of everything simultaneously. Yeah, it's all there. Yeah.
So, when you say then, like, was talked about the inference one. I think that it would be the same for both, although they'd be different things. But can you say that from the side of the subject, what we're talking about is the mode of apprehension?
Yeah, the mode of apprehension of emptiness would be the same. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Or an inference. And then there's a mode of apprehension for a direct perceiver. But they're slightly, they must be different.
Yeah, because you're apprehend for with inference, you're apprehending emptiness through the medium of a conceptual appearance. Mm-hmm. Okay. With a direct perceiver, there's no conceptual medium in there.
What's still hard for me to understand is, since you're with a direct perception perceiver, you're seeing that simultaneously everything is empty, why do you have to go through and remove things through the paths? Why doesn't it just happen
right
then? Okay. Why does it go to a different depth?
Yeah. So what your question is, why, if when you perceive emptiness directly, you're perceiving the emptiness of it, of all phenomena directly, why do you still need to eliminate?
When you see all your ops creations, they're all empty and you'd be done.
Yeah. Why don't you just get up from that meditation session and it's all finished? Why do you have to still practice once the path of seeing you have two more eons there?
Eons.
You know, two more countless great eons. Yeah. Why? That's sutra.
That's sutra, right?
Okay. So why do you still have all of that? Why doesn't everything just disappear immediately? Because the habit, the familiarity of apprehending things as truly existent and them appearing as truly existent to us, we've never known anything else. This is so deeply ingrained in our mind that we need the repetition of meditating on emptiness again and again and again and again and again to gradually cleanse the mind of all of this rubbish. Yeah, because it's like if you have a piece of cloth that's been stained for, you know, since the caveman days, you know, I don't care what detergent you use, it's not going to come clean on the first wash. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So then how is it that they say to perceive the emptiness of the self is easier than the phenomenon?
Okay. So they say the emptiness of the self is easier to understand than the emptiness of phenomena. You know, I once told this holiness, I didn't think that was true for Westerners. He thought that was hilarious. But I had a reason, you know. Well, I'll tell you the usual style, and then I'll tell you my reason. Because the usual style is probably right. Is because from the get-go, people realize that the I is imputed, that the I is not such a stable and solid thing, because in order to identify a person, one of the aggregates has to appear. Okay? You know, to identify the cup's there. To identify the person, there has to be the appearance of, you know, their body, their mind, their voice. Yeah. So already from that, there's this idea that the self is imputed on, you know, in dependence on the aggregates. Yeah. So given that there's already this feeling that the self is imputed and that the self is not so strong and stable, then that makes it easier to realize its emptiness than to realize the emptiness of the aggregates. Okay. My reason for thinking it might be the opposite for Westerners, which I'm sure is wrong, but it makes sense to me still, is that we grew up with the idea of physical things being made up of infinitesimally small particles that even if you keep subdividing, you're not going to get to the final smallest particle. Even the scientists are trying to find the smallest particle. I don't know about you, but with, you know, the way I grew up thinking with my math background and the idea of infinity, you're never going to get to the smallest anything. And so we grew up with this idea that this is not actually, it appears solid to us, but actually it's made up of many, many parts. And actually, if you look at it correctly, you could see there's no cup. It's just all these different parts. Yeah. So we grew up with that idea, whereas in ancient India, they didn't, they had this notion of, partless particles and everything. But I don't think that so many people, unless you really had a strong education, thought about that so much. Whereas for us, we have that fed into us since we're very strong, since we're very little. And on the other hand, our idea of self is like fed into us so strong since we're little. Be an individual. Be yourself. Make a statement. Be somebody. That's really hammered into us. Whereas in Asia, the idea of the self, the acquired idea of the self, is much more, it's not so individual, it's much more a group identity kind of thing. Yeah. So, that was my theory.
It seems like we've had so many different ideas about the self, and we don't have that. For us, it was just...
Right.
Our personality is set in stone, that's who we are. We grew up with that.
Yeah.
They had a rich tradition of many different views.
Yeah. Yeah, there might be different views in Western philosophy, but we don't really learn them, do we? Yeah.
I think therefore I am, that's it.
Yeah, right, right. I think therefore I am. And be your own person. Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe the average person in India didn't, but they sure have a rich tradition for centuries that looked at things in so many different ways.
Right.
Venerable, I think that my question, that was sort of the answer to it, but when you said when we perceive the emptiness of one object, you see the emptiness of all phenomena simultaneously.
That's with direct perception.
Right. So when you said that, when we're just finishing talking about this, so if you were to perceive the emptiness of the self, you wouldn't necessarily be able to perceive the emptiness of phenomena because we're saying one is more difficult for some people than others.
Yeah, when you're going about realizing emptiness, you start off meditating on the emptiness of the self, and you gain an inferential understanding of the emptiness of the self. Then you apply that to your aggregates, mm-hmm. and you get an inferential understanding mm-hmm. of the aggregates mm-hmm. is also empty of true existence. Right. Then you continue meditating, and then you will get a direct perceiver of emptiness. Mm-hmm. And at that point, your direct perception of emptiness is of the emptiness of the self, the emptiness of the aggregates, the emptiness of everything.
Of everything, including the cup and the...
Yeah, right. Okay, we did one whole verse. We've been really slow on this chapter, haven't we?
Yeah,
it's very juicy stuff. Okay. So one way to use what we went over tonight to combine with the motivation that we had is when you see a defilement coming in your mind or you see the self-centeredness going on about, I can't stand this, or I need this, or this isn't good enough, or why isn't it this way? To look at the I that's present in those statements. Yeah, because it feels so solid, doesn't it? Yeah, it's really solid. And it's like to look, and how does that I appear to exist? And if it existed in the way it appeared, I should be able to identify exactly what it is. Yeah, I should be able to identify a person if the person is inherently existent, independent of all other things. And so then you start examining how the person exists and if it is independent like that. Yeah?
Going through those different different ways that the self would have to exist.
Mm-hmm.
Can that itself help to identify the object to be negated in a way, like if we go back and forth, like trying to get a sense of the object to be negated, and then doing it, and then kind of like seeing, can that help us to see what that object that we're trying to negate is?
They usually say that to see the object, get a sense of the object of negation, is to recall a time when there's some strong emotion going on. Yeah. That's how they usually recommend doing it. Yeah. Because if you don't have some feeling for the object of negation, then when you do the analysis, you come out with, well, so what? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's nice. So what?
But if you're looking that closely at, like, you know, our aggregates, you know, and then does that help bring a sense of how I conceive myself to exist in relation to my aggregates?
Well, that's what you're investigating, is how do you conceive yourself to exist in relationship to your aggregates?
Which is the object of negation.
No, the object of negation is the inherently existent self.
Well, that's how I conceive myself to exist. That's the conceived object of the...
That's the conceived object of the grasping at true existence. But you have to identify that. And before you can negate it, you have to identify it. Otherwise, it's saying get rid of the, you know... Oh, you know what your question is like? Your question is like saying, okay, there's a thief in the house. If I wander around and look at all the people in the house, will that help me recognize who the thief is?
Mm.
Will it?
No.
No. Yeah. See. Then they say this is the hardest part of the whole thing, is to identify the object of negation. We have it all, you know, it pops up all day long.
But when you look at it, it just kind of slithers away.
Yeah. And we're so used to it. It's so natural to feel like there's this real self that even when we look at it, we don't even question that feeling. Yeah. Like when the thought comes up, I want. Yeah. I want. Do we even ever question what is that I that wants? You know, what is that?
Just give it to me.
Yeah, that's where we're at. Just give it to me. And I'm going to be so unhappy if I don't get it.
Or we might say, do I really want it? In order to try to get away from the wanting, but you're not trying to get away from the I.
Exactly, yes. And that's why they say that, you know, attachment has its own antidote, anger has its own antidote, mm-hmm. but meditation on emptiness is the antidote for all the afflictions. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for exactly that reason.
So, Venerable, I always wonder about this, because I don't know that I've... Anyway, I don't know. You look for the object. I think I have a sense sometimes that the self-sufficient, substantially existent person, the person in charge, mm-hmm. that one?
Yeah.
That one I can find. And then, so, well, then I'm going to do the 4-point on that one because I can see
yes,
that one.
Yes, yes.
That's okay
yes,
to do?
Yes,
you don't just, like,
yes.
sit there and keep looking. It's yeah. more subtle than this.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, because you have to negate the gross one. What did
okay.
that verse say?
Okay. okay.
The second
okay.
step,
okay.
get rid of the, you know,
the gross one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and then you go. And His Holiness said something really interesting when we were in India. I really like, whoa. He was saying, because they usually say, you know, to identify the truly existent self, remember some time when you were accused unfairly mm-hmm. and the reaction you had, and look at how the self existed there. And His Holiness said, that's actually identifying a gross self.
Huh.
Yeah. And he said, the subtle self, what was it? When you first wake up in the morning, the idea I.
Yeah. What Leah was saying once, some years ago when she was here, that, so it's more of one that's not so strong. You wouldn't use the example of being wrongly accused, it would be just like that.
Yeah, you have to negate the gross ones before you negate the subtle ones.
Right.
Yeah? So if we're trying to look for just that little feeling of I when it, you know, when it's just very small, like when just sometimes you can notice somebody says your name and there's just this little shake, you know. I mean, to investigate how that I exists is going to be much harder than when somebody says, "You jerk! Who in the world do you think you are?"
But you know. It is where you would go after...
But first you have to negate the gross one. Yeah. If you can't negate the gross one, how are you going to negate the subtle one? Yeah? Yeah, if we can't identify the gross one, how are we going to identify the subtle one? So, I don't know about you, I can't even identify the gross one. I'm so used to it. I don't even question it. You know? And even if somebody criticizes me or attacks me, you know, that has nothing to do with self-grasping, and it has everything to do with how the other person's wrong.
That's how you negate. Then you've got it now.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, so that's how you negate.
Yeah. But, you know, to give you some idea between the difference between the acquired and the innate, you know, Maitri doesn't have an acquired one, you know, at least this lifetime. She doesn't think, I'm a cat and, you know, you're prejudiced against cats. I'm a cat and, yes, I'm special, or, you know. Or I'm a cat, but Karuna's better than me. She's Princess Karuna, and I'm only Miss Maitri. You know? So she doesn't get into that. But she is grasping at the self. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Doesn't she?
What about her response to her name?
Her response to her name?
Mm-hmm. If you call her Maitri, she'll look at you.
Yeah.
She knows who you're talking about.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be acquired?
Yeah, that's acquired. Yes? Yeah, she just opened her eyes. Taking it in.
Do we aware at the teachings was when His Holiness said that he doesn't conceive of himself as I am the Dalai Lama, and he said that would be creating a prison. Yeah, as in that he really just relates to people as...
Yeah, as a human being. Yeah.
Yes, we love to have that I am the, I'm the.
But it really would be a prison. You know, people always think, you know, being big and being famous, it must be great. But I think it's like such a prison.
I mean, it's hard enough putting yourself into a corner, but imagine 150 billion people also putting you into a corner with that name.
Yeah. And everybody has an opinion about you, and they all believe it's
expectations.
True. And expectations, and, you know... You just want a little bit of privacy? Mm-hmm. Well, like, forget it.